and leave Toby?
He's going to do some time despite your good intentions. He used a stolen credit card. There's no way around it.
Phoebe folded a blouse and tossed it in the suitcase. What she was really saying was that they shouldn't both go down for it.
Don't you want a new start, Jamie? We could get a little apartment near the water, have a real kitchen. You could have your own room. We could sew some curtains, something yellow, someplace sunny. This is a real chance, Jamie. Think about it.
There's nothing to think about. I can't just leave him in there.
She stepped over the suitcase on her way to the door. Your father, Phoebe said, stopping Jamie when she was halfway across the room. He had good intentions, too.
My father. You mean the guy who died in a barroom fight?
She grabbed the doorknob, her skin whitening over her knuckles.
Why would you bring him up? I barely remember the man.
He died trying to protect his little brother. But it wasn't exactly a fight. It was stupid. He and Loyal weren't even that close, and the fight hadn't even started. A couple of them went outside to settle things, and your father tripped on the curb, fell and hit his head. Died on the sidewalk before the ambulance even got there. He was a handsome man. You favor him. You'd remember him if you tried.
She remembered more than she wanted. Jamie and Toby had walked into the funeral home and seen the coffin, but Toby had stayed at the back. Jamie had walked right up to it. The wood was shiny and glossy. Someone had put a small step stool by its side. She realized years later that it had been meant as a place to kneel and pray. But on that day, she'd stepped on it and hoisted herself up to see inside the coffin, to see her father's face. Up until that point, she'd never seen death up close. Not a dead bird, not even roadkill. Her father's face appeared to be smiling or maybe grimacing. But he was dead, and it was impossible that he could smile at a time like this, at this departure that she realized was completely irreversible. And at that moment, at 10 years of age, she had decided that death was a permanent state of pain. She'd lowered herself off the stool, turned to see her mother sobbing in the first row, and Loyal, with his vacant face, sitting on the opposite side and swaying slightly, the smell of whiskey hovering in the air around him. Toby had stayed at the back, his face as white as his button-down shirt, his hands clenching and unclenching, breathing through his slightly parted lips. She'd walked up the aisle, grabbed his wrist, and taken him out of there. Her mother's voice seemed an echo from the future.
He would have been proud of you. He would have wanted you to leave Blind River.
After the funeral, she and Toby had hidden in the back seat of the car until supper time, and only come into the house after everyone had gone home. But there'd been no need to hide. No one had come looking for them. Loyal was drunk and snoring on the couch. Their mother was being tended to by a neighbor who, when she saw them in the kitchen, made them each a plate of food, clumps of unrecognizable brown casseroles. Toby had swallowed mouthfuls, belched, and finished Jamie's plate. But it seemed to Jamie like she'd fallen off the earth. Her father's voice, his face, his goodnight hug, everything that had meant anything was gone. Grief was like air, everywhere and invisible, unavoidable, filling every breath she took. Remembering only left her gutted. She watched her mother on all fours reaching for something under the couch. Jamie asked her, "Did you even notice that we weren't at the funeral that day?"
"What?"
Phoebe threw a pair of sneakers into the suitcase.
"At the funeral? I hardly remember a thing from that day. But I would have sworn you were there, both of you."
"We were. For a few minutes." Jamie watched her mother fold another blouse. Snow was blowing sideways, sticking in inches despite gravity to the metal staircase, the side of the power pole. A few snowflakes blew in through the open window, across the room, settled on the arm of the couch and started melting. The draft made Jamie shiver. Phoebe said,
"Close that window. I like the cold."
But she went to the window and closed it. When are you leaving?
Loyal asked me to deal at that tournament tomorrow, and I need to get him off my back. Acts like I owe him my life. I leave after that.
She found a clean sweatshirt and pulled her work blouse off. A tattoo was on her shoulder blade. Prison quality.
You got a tattoo?
Phoebe glanced at it in the mirror.
Stupid is what I got. Another 6 months when they found the needle hidden inside my mattress.
Jamie looked closer. The Queen of Spades. You should get it touched up.
Supposed to be the card of wisdom. Whatever.
You always said, follow your heart.
But bet your spades. You remember that.
Toby says it all the time. Phoebe froze, and for a moment, Jamie thought she'd finally gotten through to her. Then she picked up the necklace Toby had shown her that day on the sidewalk, still in its box, and handed it to Jamie.
You should find the receipt and return it. I'm pretty sure he paid cash.
Jamie took the box, wishing it would bring enough to retain a lawyer, but knowing it wouldn't. Mom? I was there. I saw you in that upstairs window. Phoebe didn't react. She picked up and folded a towel.
The less you know about that night, the better.
I saw him.
What did you see? A tarp wrapped around something big. A shadow in a window. That's all you saw.
I saw his face. Phoebe held the towel to her chest, looked at Jamie.
What are you talking about?
The tarp fell off when we pulled him out of the truck. I saw his face. She braced herself in the doorway, waited for her mother to say something, childishly hoping she could make it better. Phoebe tossed the towel on top of the clothes and turned back to packing.
What can I tell you, Jamie? The best thing is to wipe that out of your mind.
She closed the suitcase lid. Chapter 31. A blast of wind followed Jamie inside the trailer. It rustled the papers spread out on the kitchen table where Loyal was adding up columns in his ledger and working to empty a quart of Jack Daniels. He said,
"God damn,"
and she hurried to shut the door. He picked up a postcard that had blown on the floor, folded it in half, and stuck it in his shirt pocket. The map he liked to look at sometimes, creased to show the eastern coast, sat next to the ledger. Got another postcard from Mr. Bobby?
Not your business.
He folded the map and stuck it in the back of the ledger. She turned away to hide her smile. Over the years, that guy had probably sent 100 postcards, and Jamie had read them all. They had their own language, nicknames, a bunch of code words that hinted at their old days together. Inside the fridge, she found bologna and a tub of mac and cheese, made a roll-up with it, and ate it over the sink.
Why don't you have friends that live in town? I got plenty of friends.
No, you don't. You got the judge, the guy in Key West, and that lady friend. She rarely mentioned the woman from the Piggly Wiggly, but she and Toby always joked about how Loyal had been screwing her in the back seat of his truck for God knows how many years. She didn't understand this man, and it nagged at her. How had her life come to such shit in just 19 years? She had gained nothing by keeping quiet. He stared at the ledger, wrote down some numbers.
I'm just saying, you've lived in this town your whole life. I got more friends than you.
He looked up from the ledger.
Maybe I've been busy. You ever think of that, huh? Maybe I've been raising two kids weren't my own. Maybe I've been working real hard for 10 years to keep the two of you out of foster care.
Foster care. Whenever Jamie heard those words, she remembered the couple that had wanted them. But when she tried to conjure their image, all she saw was a green lawn, a white picket fence, and the vague shape of two adults. What's so bad about foster care?
What's so bad about it? Kids get fucked in foster care. Literally. Don't you know that? They get separated, farmed out for labor, not fed right.
What are you talking about? That shit doesn't happen anymore.
The hell it doesn't.
But there were people who wanted to adopt us. He pointed at her.
You, God damn it, were raised by family, not strangers. Do Do you know how much I gave up to stay here and keep the two of you? No, you don't. You have no idea.
Staying here? You grew up here. Your life was here way before me and Toby.
I was moving down to Key West. Had it all planned out. Instead, your mother goes to jail and leaves the two of you to me. Drug-stealing bitch. And whatever you think you know, you can be sure you're wrong. You know nothing about the whole thing.
I know you got a lot of stupid pride. Probably why you run so low on friends. This seemed to hurt him, and she felt a little good about that. He rubbed his eyes like his vision was blurring, like he did when he'd had too much whiskey. It could go either way now. She'd get another backhand, or he'd stumble to his bedroom and sleep it off. Not for the first time. She imagined ducking the slap, catching him off balance, and her coming around with a blow to the back of his head. He started to stand, and she flinched. But then he leaned back in his chair and shook his head.
Keating is not my friend. I paid him a great deal of money to keep the two of you out of the system. A great deal. And I never took a dime of that welfare.
What? We sleep on camping cots in a storage room. He was deluded, telling himself he'd done a good job, being so damn proud. We could have used some welfare.
You had enough, and you were raised by family.
He pointed at her.
And you know where you came from.
She should have run when she'd had the chance. What was the good of knowing where you came from if you came from shit? Not knowing had to be better.
Yeah, I know where I come from. My father's dead and my mother's a thief.
And my uncle's a con man.
Welcome to the real world. It's about time you grew up.
He offered her the bottle of whiskey and she drank from it.
Did you see Toby?
He asked. Yeah, I saw him.
How'd he take it?
What the hell do you care? He stared at the bottle for a moment.
Huh. Maybe I don't. What I do care about is tomorrow. Make sure you get some sleep. Be sharp for the game.
He started to stand, but a car turned into the driveway out front, its lights shining briefly on the wall behind him. The lights went off, and a woman stepped out of the car and into the porch light.
God damn, Jamie said. What's Shilkins want?
The only reason the woman would show up unannounced at this hour was if Toby was in trouble. Opening the front door, Jamie had the urge to flee down the street. Instead, she met Jilkins' eyes and asked, What happened?
Toby's been moved to medical detention.
Jilkins climbed the last step and stomped the sludge off her shoes.
Why? Was there a fight?
The baloney turned inside Jamie's stomach. Jilkins came inside.
No, it wasn't like that. No one thought he was a danger to himself, so the guards left him alone. I'm sorry to have to put it so bluntly, but he tried to hang himself.
Jamie's mind flashed with a vision of her brother dangling from metal bars, loose-limbed and dead. She braced herself against the wall.
Is he dead? No, he's not dead. But he's hurt.
Loyal sat at the kitchen table, mute and seemingly unfazed. Jamie knew by the look in his eye that he wasn't just done with Toby. He was done with both of them. He pushed himself to his feet and thudded down the hallway to his room. Ms. Jilkins led Jamie to the couch and got her a glass of water. It was a small act, but the woman's kindness was almost too much to handle. She swallowed some water, felt the sting of tears, the burnt hole on the couch. The one Toby had picked at until it had grown to the size of a fist was right there at her fingertips. She picked up a loose thread, felt the room begin to fall away, heard a warm buzz in her ear and realized Jilkins was talking.
I see it all the time. Kids like Toby are like a tidal wave that just rolls over you. Parents think they're creating something better than themselves, something beautiful and wondrous, but it isn't like that. Kids are their own form of grief. If they don't pull you under, they show you what you're made of.
In his bedroom, Loyal dropped his boots, one after the other, on the floor. She heard the clunk of the lid of his lockbox drop to the floor. He'd be snoring soon, and Jamie hated him even more for that.
How? What did he use? Jamie asked.
Jilkins sank into the couch. The movement rippled Jamie's brain and the room spun. She looked at the woman's face, needing the steady sound of her voice, but lamplight fell across her face, making it look like a skull.
"I don't," Jilkins halted. "I don't have all the details."
What did it matter anyway? Shoestrings, sheets, his ripped up t-shirt. There were only so many possibilities.
"How bad is he?"
"His windpipe is crushed. It isn't good, but he'll recover."
Her thoughts spun out as if she had no control over them. Toby in that jail cell, his face red, his eyes distant and vacant. Why hadn't she just taken his hand?
"Can I see him?"
Jilkins seemed so far away. But when Jamie tried, she was able to focus on the shadows falling on her face, the familiar sound of her voice.
"No. He's an injured minor in custody. I'm sorry, but the only people the police will allow in will be a parent or a guardian."
The woman exhaled. She seemed deflated. Her lips trembled slightly, and Jamie wondered how much of this she felt. She'd known them going on 8 years.
"He's heavily sedated anyway, and on a breathing machine. And he's going to need months of rehab."
Jilkins looked at the ceiling.
"I always worried something like this might happen. Don't get me wrong, Toby is a beautiful kid. But he was always in motion, never at peace, and the cards were always stacked against him."
"Were they?"
"No, not always. But it would seem that way to Ms. Jilkins, someone who had only seen the hard years."
"I want it better for you too,"
Ms. Jilkins said.
"But all I could do was keep an eye on you. I never understood why the judge decided to leave you here when there was that family waiting for a boy and girl."
She glanced darkly down the hallway.
"I mean, look at this place. Your uncle was clearly unprepared to raise children. Even with all that government assistance, it seemed like that money would have gone further than this."
Jamie had never thought of Jilkins as having kept an eye on them. She only seemed to come around to cause problems. But now Jamie wondered if she'd had it wrong. Maybe Jilkins had come around only when problems came up. Jamie had never told Toby about the couple who had wanted them. Foster care might have made the difference. Maybe he wouldn't have been such a bully if they'd gone to live with a real family. Maybe they would have gotten adopted, gotten a different name, grown up without the elder's curse.
"I mean, why didn't he go all the way and grant loyal custody?"
Ms. Jilkins continued.
"Why keep family services involved?
Loyal would never have accepted a dime of welfare."
"It wasn't welfare. It was Social Security benefits for your father's dependents. Once your mother went to, away, your uncle got those payments. I filed the forms for you and Toby myself. That's why I wanted you to get in college right away. Those benefits run out at 21 if you aren't in school."
Jamie stared at her hands as the pieces slid together in her brain. "I paid him a great deal of money to keep the two of you out of the system." Their benefits had been funneled straight to Keating's re-election campaigns, while she'd lived most of her life feeling like a burden, like a criminal for needing Pop-Tarts and pencils. Loyal was deluded, saying it was family duty and pride.
It wasn't.
He protected his gambling operations by bribing the judge, and Keating kept family services involved to keep Loyal in line, to keep the donations coming in. She thought the word out loud.
"Donations."
Ms. Jilkins looked at Jamie blankly.
"What donations?"
"Never mind." Jamie looked around the trailer at the broken windows, the ruined couch.
She'd been a fool.
He'd been so enraged when he found out she'd flunked that first semester, and now she understood why. The benefits, pride had nothing to do with it.
"You poor kids."
Ms. Jilkins picked up a framed photo of Toby off the coffee table, his high school portrait, and ran her fingers over his face.
"None of this would have happened if your mother hadn't taken that prescription."
Jamie was tired of hearing how her mother was a thief. She took the photo from Jilkins and wiped the glass with her sleeve. Another, smaller photo sat in front of the portrait. Toby and Jamie about the time of their dad's funeral, her arm draped over his shoulders, his eyes shut, wearing a goofy smile. She'd never meant to leave him on his own, but she had. All those nights she'd spent with Jack, ignoring Toby, thinking he was finally big enough to take care of himself. Without knowing when she'd done it, she had taken on the responsibility to see him grow up. But Jack had come along and she'd gotten distracted. She tried to remember her last conversation with Toby. Was she the last person to have talked to him or seen him? Why hadn't she been kinder? Jilkins pulled a tissue out of her pocket, blew her nose.
He must have been desperate to rob that man.
The words banged inside Jamie's head. He didn't rob anyone.
The police think he did.
And you believe them?
Why else would he try to take his own life, Jamie? People get hurt in robberies. For all we know, that man is dead.
It didn't happen that way. Goddamn. Had Toby confessed? He'd been so worried about Phoebe's happiness after Jamie told him about Keating. It had been stupid to implicate Phoebe while Toby was locked up. He might have tried to take the rap for this thing just to close down the investigation. But Jamie couldn't tell Jilkins any of that.
The man's been missing for days.
Jilkins rubbed the back of her head and sighed.
But of course, you know your brother best.
Ms. Jilkins yawned, and Jamie saw the dark circles beneath her eyes.
It's late. You should go.
Will you be okay? I hate to leave you like this.
I'll be fine, she said. Really. I'll call if I need anything.
Try and get some sleep.
Ms. Jilkins picked up her keys and purse. At the door, she said,
I'm just a phone call away.
The lights of her car flicked over the walls as she backed out of the driveway. Jamie sat for a while staring at the hole in the couch, the dismal walls, her brother's picture. She couldn't settle. She walked to the front door and then back to the kitchen, where she poured some water over the dried up potted ivy on the windowsill. Every noise spooked her. The fridge compressor kicking on, a squirrel scuttling across the roof, a pine cone falling on the front porch. This place could never be her home again. She texted Jack, hoping he was still at the store, turned on the TV to drown out the silence. In the back room, she saw that Toby had left in a rage. The window over his cot had been kicked out. Shards of glass were on the floor and his pillowcase. A draft blew in through the opening. Diesel engines idled in the street outside. Yellow utility truck lights pulsed against the night. The neighborhood dogs barked in their kennels. A worker climbed into a cherry picker as three men watched, their faces lit by intermittent lights, their hard hats casting long shadows on the road. The generator kicked on as the truck lifted a worker up to repair the streetlight. Toby's muddy sneakers, laces broken, stuck out from under the bed, where she made him keep them because they stank. His clothes were where he'd left them, thrown on the floor, slung over the metal footboard, half jammed under his pillow. His science book was sticking out from under his cot, gathering dust. His Game Boy sat on the dresser, grimed with Dorito cheese muck. She ripped the army poster off the wall and tore it in half. She untied the length of rope he used to practice knots and stuffed it under his bed. Inside the dresser, she found the wallet she'd given him for Christmas, the one he didn't use because he loved the one Phoebe had given him for his 8th birthday. He used the new one to save things in, the one letter his mother had written from prison, pictures he loved. Jamie knew them all by heart. Toby on his first day of school, his skinny arms wrapped around a gigantic book bag, refusing to smile for the camera. The pocket-sized version of his 7th grade portrait. He looked just like their uncle with his hair slicked and combed back, though Jamie would never mention that to his face. A snapshot of him blowing out birthday candles at the kitchen table, Phoebe sitting next to him smoking a cigarette. Probably the last cake she ever baked. A square of plastic fell out of the wallet. A condom, the kind the science teachers handed out on AIDS awareness days. She almost wanted to cry, wondering if he'd ever had the chance to use one. If he would have even bothered,
or if he just liked the possibilities that came with keeping one in his wallet. The last photo was of her and Toby. He was laughing maniacally while her mouth gaped, and she looked wildly at the space above the camera. Phoebe had taken the picture, just after he'd poured ice water down the back of Jamie's shirt. She'd hated him in that moment. Hated Phoebe, too, because it had been her idea. It was always like that with the two of them. The Elder's Clan time bomb ticked in his DNA, and Phoebe had done nothing to keep him safe. Always in on it, always encouraging his pranks, like she didn't know all that would lead a boy like Toby straight to juvie or the ICU. On the TV in the outer room, Lena Bangor was on the local news. The newscaster said charges were pending against a juvenile suspect, already in custody. Lena held up a photograph of her father, announcing a reward for information leading to his whereabouts. How basic was it, this need to bury the dead? She picked up Loyal's empty whiskey bottle and started to throw it in the garbage, then set it back on the table. If she didn't get out of here now, her future was more of this. More of this place, more cleaning up after him. She sat in his chair at the kitchen table, opened the ledger. On the front pages, he'd written the locations of every coin pusher, slot machine, and fake lottery ticket dispenser. 37 locations. There was another set of numbers in the back, a column with her name, and one with Toby's, along with monthly deposits into a checking account. Over 100 entries. Enough money to have hired a team of lawyers for Toby. A bank statement sat on top of the stack of mail she'd brought in. She opened it, read the balance. 20 cents. There were only two transactions. The day after the state's deposit had come, there was a corresponding withdrawal. The bastard had given every cent of it to Keating, and according to what Jilkins had told her, he'd been giving Keating that money every month for 8 years. All that money, while she and Toby had nothing. She went into Loyal's room. He was passed out face down, one arm dangling off the side of the bed, the latest postcard from Bobby showing under his pillow. The streetlight blinked on and lit the room in a yellow haze. His pack of cigarettes and an overflowing ashtray sat near where his hand rested on the floor. He tossed his belt on a chair. His shotgun stood in the corner next to a box of shells. She kicked over the box and the shells scattered across the floor. He didn't budge. She picked up one, loaded the shotgun, and felt the weight of it in her hands. A sweat broke out on the back of her neck. His sleeping head fit neatly in the shotgun's sights. Jamie stood there panting. This was exactly what the world expected from her. The Elder's girl gone bad. She wavered. A plan began taking shape. A new idea. She decided on it. Lowered the gun. He snored and mumbled something in his sleep. She laid the gun down on the bed next to him where he would wake up next to it in the morning. In the outer room, she found Keating's cell phone in the bottom of her backpack, did what she needed to do, and packed up. Chapter 32. A fire truck idled loudly in the emergency drive outside the hospital where Toby and Jamie had been born. From the sidewalk, she looked up at the darkened windows, wondering which room he was in and if he would be able to see the sky when he opened his eyes. She hoped he was warm. The memory of their last conversation haunted her, his slumped shoulders and the defeat in his eyes when she'd carried on about Phoebe. She crossed to the sidewalk beside the courthouse. Keating's Cadillac was parked in a reserved space, and she fought the urge to key it because security cameras were bolted every 50 feet on the buildings and utility poles. Men like Keating ran this town by keeping an eye on people like her. But if Toby knew what she knew now, he wouldn't have cared about those cameras. He'd have keyed the entire car and slit the tires. He was fearless that way. Jack finally texted back, saying he would wait for her at the store. She walked down Main under streetlights turned hazy by an evening fog. Her nose started to run again. What she really needed was to curl up under a blanket on the futon,
but when she turned the corner, she stopped short.
Shit.
Billy's truck was outside Jack's door. She went inside anyway. The store smelled like cinnamon from the can of room deodorizer he used whenever he smoked pot. Jack came out of the back room with bloodshot eyes.
What's Billy doing here? She asked.
He's got some good shit. Come to the back and try it.
She wanted to be alone with him, to slide up next to him and thaw. Now she'd have to wait until Billy left. He took her hand and led her into the office.
Want one?
He asked, popping a beer. Billy sat on the futon, happily sucking on a pipe. He offered it to her. She waved off the pipe but took the beer. Billy Wages hadn't smiled at her since his wedding day, and she wondered if he'd scored some of the medicinal happy weed he always bragged about. He blew smoke at the ceiling. Jack took the pipe from him and slid into the chair behind the desk.
What's up, Jamie?
She hated the cool tone he used when other people were around, like Billy didn't know they were sleeping together.
What's up?
It was hard to know where to begin. It would take an hour to catch them up on everything that had happened, and another hour to repeat it once the pot wore off. The light from the laptop lit Jack's face. He glanced at Billy, who smiled at Jamie again. It had to be the weed. Their mood was not right for this kind of news, and it made her feel weird when she blurted out,
"It's Toby."
Jack closed the laptop and took a deep draw on the pipe. He tried to hold it in and coughed.
"Of course it is. It's always Toby. Dude's cray."
Billy's eyes were bright and watery.
"Yeah, and you aren't? The guy who knocked up his girlfriend at the prom, then had to get a job at a fertilizer plant working the graveyard shift and selling pot on the side to pay for the kid?"
"Fuck off,"
Billy said, laughing because it was true. Someone came in the front door and rang the service bell.
"No fighting, you two,"
Jack said and went out front. Jamie slid behind the desk, silently willing Billy to leave, hoping Jack would let her spend the night in the office, even if he couldn't stay. Light from the small window lit Billy's face with an eerie green glow. The bottle of sleeping pills Jack sometimes gave her was next to the laptop. Once she took one, though, she'd be out. Billy was still smiling at her, even though she'd just insulted him.
"The fuck is it with you?"
she asked. He reached over, his hand passing too close to her breast, and opened the laptop. The screen came to life and he hit the play button.
"You're the fuck it is,"
he said. He dropped back onto the futon and stretched, crossing his arms behind his head. The image didn't make sense. Not at first, anyway. Something about the scene was familiar but strange. The guy in the video was getting blown. Billy and Jack had been watching porn, like they always did when they hung out. A creepy habit, but that was what dudes did, watch porn and smoke dope. The picture was blurry. Then the guy smiled at the camera and Jamie recognized Jack. He held the girl by the back of the head, then pushed her off him and yanked off her jeans. For a moment, Jamie didn't recognize herself. This had to be some other girl. But in the video, she saw Jack's desk, an open bottle of wine, the futon, and a girl flat on her back. Jack was biting her nipples, stopping once more to turn and smile at the camera. Then he slid down her body, his face between her legs.
"You are the bomb,"
Billy laughed, holding his crotch. And that's when Jamie knew for sure. She stared at the screen, unable to move, her heart stomping in her chest, white heat exploding in her throat. She didn't remember any of it, but she recognized herself, moaning, flailing, orgasmic. He'd given her a pill two nights ago, and she'd been sore the whole next day. She grabbed the laptop and threw it at the wall. The lid busted halfway off and the screen went dead. She picked it up again and threw it at Billy. He'd seen her at her most vulnerable and he couldn't stop laughing. He blocked it with his knee and kept laughing. Nothing in her life had prepared her for this much rage. She felt the room sway and the edges of her vision blur. She grabbed the bottle of pills, dumped them into her hand. Billy laughed as he followed her to the front room.
"What's the problem?"
Jack was counting out bills to an old woman. Her eyes widened behind her glasses. She grabbed her cash and stuffed it in her purse.
"Hold on," Jack said. "How could you?"
He held his hand up.
"It isn't what you'd think. Fuck you,"
she screamed. She fought to breathe. Her brain leaped wildly from shame to fury and back to shame. Billy leaned against the door jamb, giggling. The woman clutched her purse to her chest.
Ooh, she mad, she said and turned to Jack.
Boy, what you gone done?
Jamie leaped at Jack.
What are you doing?
He grabbed her, but rage made her stronger than she'd ever been. She jammed the pills into his mouth, but he clamped his mouth shut, grabbed her wrist, and squeezed. Most of the pills fell on the floor. Then his hand was in her face. He spit out the ones that had slipped through, swore at her. The woman backed away.
Girl, you make him pay.
You're a fucking asshole.
She tried to shout, but there was no air in her lungs, and it came out as a whisper.
Did you put this online?
What?
No.
Billy was bent over and laughing, trying to catch his breath. Jamie lunged at him and landed an elbow on his chin. He smacked the counter on his way down and landed at the woman's feet. Jamie grabbed the keys to Jack's car from under the counter, said,
God damn you,
and kicked open the front door. Chapter 33.
Fuck him.
The words looped maniacally in her brain.
Fuck them all.
Her mind replayed the image of herself in the video. On her knees, on her back, naked and writhing, and Billy laughing in her face, laughing so hard he couldn't breathe, and she felt filthy. Her face burned as though on fire. Rage liquefied her muscles, made her want to hit things, brought forth involuntary tears, buzzed inside her ears. It would take a lake, a river, an ocean of water to ever feel clean again. Fury funneled into a kind of lucidity that she recognized as fate, as though the next 24 hours were already history. It was clear what she needed to do, where she had to go. She aimed Jack's car north and gunned it up Main Street. Betrayal wasn't a state of mind where her brain could rest. It wasn't static, like death or defeat, and already its alchemy began to change her. Already, she felt the heat inside her chest cooling into something new, something wary and wild. Something that could stand flat-footed in the middle of a burning house and calculate the next move. She passed the courthouse and the jail, Keating's Cadillac and Garcia's crappy sedan, the hospital. The streetlights ended at the edge of town. She gunned it on the highway. She rolled down the windows. Cold air was life, and she breathed it in, screamed it out.
Fuck you all!
If she survived the next day, she'd get those words tattooed on her arm. The first billboard for Mimowa lit her windshield with a yellow glow, and she passed it going 80. The next billboard was a neon rainbow, and she eased up on the gas. The last one was a pot of gold, and she let the car slow. She cruised past the exit and took the underpass where the road narrowed and turned to gravel. The shoulder dropped off to the right, but she remembered how her weight had shifted to the left that night on the floorboard of Loyal's truck. She found a flashlight in the console and shined it out the window as she drove slowly, hoping to see a bend in the road, a crook in a tree, something to trigger the memory of this place. The pavement ended and turned into a dirt road. She remembered potholes and weeds slapping at the fenders. The county didn't maintain roads this far outside of town or on private land. A black silhouette stepped onto the road and Jamie braked. Her heart banged in her throat. Anyone could be out here. A hunter, a lunatic, an escapee from the penitentiary one county over. A massive head swiveled on a giant gray torso. A stag stared unblinking into the headlights. Her throat turned to ice. Insanely, she thought of the stag from all those years ago, but it couldn't be the same one. They'd eaten venison that whole summer, and this one was even bigger than the one she'd killed. He was unfazed by the headlights, his gaze coming straight at her through the windshield. He lifted his head, sniffed the air, and blew a moist spray out his nose. She cut the engine. The animal ignored her and continued across the road. Jamie turned off the lights to let her eyes adjust to the dark. A half moon sat over the field, its light shining along the length of the stag's back as he walked through the grass and disappeared at the edge of the woods. Farther up was a broken gate, rusted and off its hinges. Old fence posts sagged under ancient wisteria vines. A washed-out path dropped left, where a single pine tree stood in the center of the field. She got her backpack and walked. The sky was black and silky, the ground soft beneath her boots. An owl called out, and she froze as though caught in a childhood nightmare. The way she pitched between fear and anger was exhausting. Nothing worse could happen.
Nothing more could be lost. She could be afraid for the rest of her life. But now, she knew, fear had never kept her safe. It was time to get some damn courage. Whatever happened tomorrow, this night belonged to her. The pine glowed silver in the moonlight. Ladder rungs were nailed to its trunk, one slat every few feet. The floor of what looked like a treehouse hovered midway up the tree. She recalled her 13th birthday, more than 5 years ago. The contour of the branches extending from the trunk, the low walls surrounding the hidden platform. Nothing had changed. This wasn't a treehouse. This was the old hunter's blind. She tested her weight on the first rung. It held, and she climbed another. There were seven in all. The floor of the blind was a grid of 2x4s covered by plywood with a hole cut in the bottom for access. She banged the flashlight against the floorboards to flush out any animal that might have nested there. Claws scratched against the floor and she ducked, raising her arm protectively against a rustle of wings. A large bird leapt up and flew from the tree, gliding out over the field. Holding the flashlight up, she looked into the opening. A short wall surrounded the blind, tall enough that when she climbed through and sat down, she could see out over the top. The floor was covered with pine needles and twigs, the remnants of a nest. She shined the flashlight into the overhead branches, checked the floors for bugs and the corners for snakes. She cleared a space and leaned against a wall that was the exact height needed to steady a rifle. Her phone startled her when it blinged and lit up with a text from Jack, demanding to know where she was and that she bring his car back. She turned the phone off. Even if she could tell him where she was, she wouldn't. Somewhere in a field outside of town, where no one would ever find her. The realization calmed her. No one knew where she was. All around her, the typical graffiti was carved into the walls, initials scratched with pen knives, some set inside the shape of a heart. She imagined lovers coming up here. Jack might have taken her someplace like this if he hadn't had that futon in his office. If only he hadn't had that office. When she closed her eyes, the images from the sex tape played in her mind, a torture that would last a lifetime. She opened her eyes and stared at the tree, trying not to see what had been burned into her memory. She searched the walls closely. On the opposite wall, she found a tee, the one Toby had scratched that cold morning when Loyal had dragged them out of their beds to hunt. In the blind, they'd been bored, cold, but alert. Toby had taken Loyal's field knife to scratch his name and gotten as far as the tee before the stag appeared and all hell broke loose. As she traced the letter with her fingertip, she felt a grief for the emptiness of Toby's small life as sharply as the grief she felt for her father. Toby wasn't even full grown, and he'd already been arrested. Twice. Toby's initial, a simple mark on a tree, might be all the boy ever left behind. She dug through her backpack for a Sharpie and used it to ink the tea with a vine that curled and blossomed with ivy leaves. Nothing would be the same after tonight. It was clear what her life would be if she stayed in Blind River and let Loyal boss her around. Maybe she'd end up slightly better off than her mother. Maybe she'd manage to stay out of prison. The future was set unless she found her own way, unless she got out of here. When she was done with his initial, it filled an area as big as a tombstone and she was calmer. She wanted to say a prayer for her brother, but all she could think of was, "Our Father," and she didn't know the rest, so she stared at the moon and thought through what she'd do in the morning. She'd use her backpack as a pillow and lay down for the night, doubting sleep would come, but taking comfort in solitude, in the empty field glowing silver under the moon. Chapter 34. Jamie shivered awake when light began to brighten the eastern sky. She rubbed her hands and cheeks, turned to watch the sun lift beyond the tree line, surprised at how hard she'd slept under nothing but pine canopy and sky. She scanned the area. The car sat on the dirt road where she'd left it, near the broken gate. A ravine dropped off 100 yards to the east.
Sunlight spread over the field, and she shielded her eyes from the reflection off the barn's tin roof. She climbed down from the blind and walked in the direction of the sun. The slope of the ravine was steeper than she remembered, the funeral mound smaller than it had seemed that night. The air smelled sour. She pulled the brush and the tree limbs away until the stones were exposed. They were so purposefully placed, it could never have been confused with a rock slide. It was wrong to be here, standing over this man's body, when his family didn't even know he was dead. She looked around until she was sure she had her bearings, then headed back to the car to let the engine run and get warm. She turned on her phone. The first of 15 messages from Jack demanded that she return his car. She wanted to set it on fire. She skipped to the last one offering an apology and deleted the ones in between. In a few minutes, the car was warm and her body began to thaw. It had to be 8 o'clock. By now, folks would be heading to the Veterans Hall for the tournament. Loyal would be there setting up chairs and tables, putting the coffee on, setting out bags of pretzels. She backed the car through the weeds to the dirt road and drove to the highway, south toward the 7-Eleven. She resisted the impulse to drive Jack's car through the glass doorfront, and instead went inside and bought a cup of coffee and a jug of bleach. Then she parked on the bend around the corner from a stand of pine trees and looked through the pictures she'd taken of Loyal's ledger one more time, hit the send button, and waited for the bling that told her the message had gone through. Then she drove to the bridge. Icicles hung off its railings. She pulled to the center and got out, Keating's cell phone heavy in her hand. Runoff from the fertilizer plant upstream smelt foul but earthy. Debris caught on the frozen ice and swirled in foamed eddies. She threw the phone as far as she could. It splashed and floated downstream for a moment, hit a fallen tree trunk and sank. She drove to the Veterans Hall. 100 or more cars were parked on side streets and in the surrounding vacant lots. Men milled around outside the hall, smoking their last cigarettes before the kickoff. She parked the car on the street and poured the gallon of bleach into Jack's gas tank. When she saw Loyal's truck, she wished she'd bought 2 jugs. A handwritten poster taped to the front door listed the tournament jackpot. She did some quick calculations. There had to be over 100 entries. She hated that she'd agreed to collude with Phoebe, Jack, and Tuckahoe. The thought of collaborating with any of them on anything put a vile taste in her mouth. But spending the day in her uncle's presence was her best cover. She swallowed hard and went inside. A picture of TJ was taped to the wall behind the check-in table, along with a note about a reward for information leading to his whereabouts. It made her sick to see that man's face. Maybe he'd been a kind man, a good father. Her mind went to Toby. He'd never graduate from high school now or join the army and become a soldier. She'd never have to worry about him getting blown up in a tank or getting shot in combat. Blind River would never forgive him for his part in this thing. They'd already labeled him as one more troubled boy, and any argument against that was futile. Eddie from Crowley's Pub was collecting tournament entry fees. He closed the lockbox and slid it under his chair.
You're Loyal's girl, right?
The smirk on his face told her he knew exactly who she was. Niece.
Got here in the nick of time, he said. You waived your buy-in.
As a juvenile, Toby's identity should have been protected. But that smirk said something different. By now, the whole town would be talking about the missing persons investigation, and everyone would see her as the sister of the guy who'd been arrested. But that smirk also told her that word of the attempted suicide hadn't got out. Eddie gave her a card with her table and seat number on it.
Over there,
he said, pointing. The hall was dingy and gray, filled with round folding tables and metal chairs. Flags from various armed services were tacked on the walls. There was a coffee station in the back near a small stage with a microphone. Her seat was at a table near the back, and she snaked through the room to find it. Judging by the size of the crowd, she guessed the tournament would run until late afternoon. Most of the players had already found their seats and sat eyeing their opponents, trying to gauge the level of competition. Loyal meandered through the crowd, greeting players. One day a year,
Loyal Elders was elevated from the redneck country boy they knew him to be to the man who ran the annual veterans fundraiser. Over the years, those days had amounted to a bond of sorts. And even though he'd never even considered joining the military, and even though he tore his parking tickets up, and even though the money raised from this tournament never quite made it into anything tangible for the Veterans Hall, the fact that he ran it every year, and that the men had a good time, earned him their admiration, if only for a day. The average age, she guessed by the gray hair and beer bellies and the flasks hanging out their back pockets, was 60-something. These men had been playing cards their whole lives, and they'd be tricky. Once they saw her, they'd come gunning because no one here wanted to get beat by the only girl in the tournament. It seemed her eyes had a will of their own, because the first person they landed on was Jack, sitting at a table near the front. She swerved toward him. His slumping posture and sunken eyes and scraggly beard suggested he'd had a rough night. She slung the keys at him fast. When he caught them from smacking his face, she was disappointed, but kept moving. Phoebe, dressed in her starched white shirt and black vest, sat in the dealer's position at a table in the center of the room. When she looked up and smiled, Jamie's heart felt like a stone wedged between her lungs. Jilkins despised Phoebe, and wouldn't have told her about Toby. Loyal wouldn't have said anything that might mess up the tournament. There was nothing anyone could do for Toby anyway, and Jamie decided not to tell her until the end of the day. She passed Tuckahoe and her fists clenched. He rolled a chip in between his fingers like a magician, but when he saw her, he touched his nose in a stupid signal of their collaboration. Chip dumping with a pervert, an unfaithful husband, and an ex-con. The fuck you all mantra started looping through her brain again as she found her seat. Loyal went to the front of the room and tapped the microphone with his finger, sending a screech through the speakers. The crowd quieted. A young guy and a middle-aged woman sat in folding chairs by the stage. They seemed removed, like they didn't really want to be in this room. Loyal handed the microphone to Keating, who wanted to make an announcement before the game started, because he could never pass up cheap publicity for his re-election campaign. When the girl stepped out from behind Keating, Jamie's mind iced over. The girl looked exhausted and worn out, even smaller than Jamie remembered from that afternoon in Crowley's pub. Keating said, "You all know that TJ Bangor wanted to play in this tournament, and you probably all know that he, hasn't been seen for a couple of days." A murmur went through the crowd. Phoebe's face turned as pale as marble. Keating put his arm around the girl's shoulders. "But his daughter, Lena, is here in his stead." He gave Lena a crushing squeeze. She stumbled against his bulk, but his hold on her kept her from falling. The crowd made a low, approving noise. He looked at the girl with a tenderness that made Jamie scream inside. She slipped lower into her chair, wanting to disappear. "We want you to know," he said, "that we're praying for your father's safe return." The girl seemed to shrink beneath the weight of his arm. Keating wiped a non-existent tear. "And we're going to play this tournament in his honor." The sham was unbearable. "Now do us a favor, honey." The bastard had already forgotten her name. "Start the tournament for us?" He lowered the microphone to her and the girl said softly,
"Shuffle up and deal."
There was some scattered applause before the room went quiet and the cards started flying. Keating took his seat at a table near the front. Lena stood there alone for a moment, her shoulders narrow, her eyes wide and brown, glancing around the room until the guy and woman came to her side. They had to be her brother, or maybe a cousin, and Mrs. Bangor. They looked so broken. Jamie mucked the first round of cards without even looking at them and watched them walk to the entrance and out the front doors. Jamie gripped the edge of her chair. What was she waiting for? Better timing? For who? Herself? There was only one right thing to do. She stood, about to follow after them, just as Loyal walked up behind Jamie and gripped her shoulder with his hand. She collapsed back into her chair, felt him move in closer,
smelled the whiskey on his breath when he leaned over and whispered in her ear,
"Don't even think about it."
Chapter 35. Thinking about bombing out on that first hand at Mimawa still stung enough that Jamie folded every hand for the first 30 minutes. But once she'd settled in enough and got a read on the other players, she decided it was time to play. An hour later, she'd doubled the size of her stack by making a few key bluffs. Now it was time to turn up the heat. She peeked at her hole cards, saw a suited king nine, and tossed a couple of chips into the pot. The action went clockwise around the table, and everyone folded except the old guy to her right. He played tight, but in the last 30 minutes, Jamie had taken a giant pot from him with a bluff too big for any sane person to call. He called her bet now, and the dealer spread the first of the community cards on the table. A king, 10, and a 9. The old guy checked, and Jamie bet out hard.
"Why so much?" he asked.
"Guess I'm scared you hit something on the flop," she said. Her stomach growled, but all she found in the bottom of her backpack was the remnants of a spilled bag of trail mix and a roll of Tums. It would have to do. The old guy looked at his cards for a full minute. She knew he would fold, and tanking on his decision like this was just his way of saving face. He didn't fold until the other player started complaining, then mucked his cards face up. A king jack, and Jamie almost laughed. Old guys hated folding paint, and they showed their hand every time as though to prove some point. He smirked and said,
"Nice hand, little lady."
She hated the word lady, but said nothing. Her next hand was a pair of jacks, and she made the same play against him, knowing there was no way he'd let her keep stealing pots. He called her bet. They flipped their cards, and he had a pair of eights. Her jacks held up, and he was out.
"A girl like you,"
he said, letting his eyes drift from her face to her chest and back.
"Steamrolls like you got nothing to lose. Maybe you should slow down once in a while,"
she said. "Yes, sir. I'll pull up a little if it's better for you." She meant for her style to annoy other players, stayed unpredictable in order to throw them off balance, but hated when she won a hand and the loser told her how to play. His buddies chuckled and one of them said,
"Watch yourself. That's Loyal's niece. You can bet she knows a thing or two."
She folded the next few hands, trying to stay under the radar. What she needed was to sit tight as long as possible and let things play out, give herself a solid alibi. A couple of small hands went her way, and she built her stack a little more. 30 minutes later, the dealers rotated and Phoebe landed at Tuckahoe's table. Jamie glanced over and saw he was holding his own, but with the first hand Phoebe dealt him, he shoved all the chips to the center. One other player called him and they turned their cards over. His pair of nines were up against a pair of queens. When another nine hit the river, Tuckahoe won and his opponent was out. Tuckahoe caught Jamie looking at him, smiled and tapped his nose. She stared at his stupid face, caught up in remembering the satisfying smack of her elbow against Billy's face last night. 2 hours later, Jamie had knocked out two more players and built her stack to 50,000 chips, enough to coast for another hour or two. There were 26 players and 3 tables left in the game. When they got down to 20 players, Loyal moved Tuckahoe to her table. He sat down and touched his nose, and Jamie had to dig her fingernails into her wrist to keep herself from leaping across the table and punching him in the throat. An hour later, they were down to 16 players. If she kept her end of the bargain, she'd go up against Jack and then Keating. She hated this, hated the idea of losing a single chip to any of these men. When the dealers rotated for the last time, Phoebe landed at her table and dealt Jamie some big cards. She never knew who had taught her mother the mechanics of card manipulation, but the woman was a magician when it came to sticking aces. Sitting at the same table with her now brought the memories back. All those days and nights spent around their kitchen table when she was little. Phoebe's fingers quick as lightning, Jamie soaking up the odds of making various hands, the thrill of catching her mother pulling an ace off the bottom of the deck for the first time.